Muslim 360.
Talk Unchained.
What exactly is Talk Unchained?
It's going to be a mix of business and economics, politics, education, a little bit of international affairs. Talk Unchained. What I try to do is I try to be very informative and a little bit provocative at the same time.
Talk Unchained with Marlon Aldridge.
It's going to be something that's going to blow your mind, man, because I like to dig real deep, that research piece, and then just shock and awe, man. That's my style, the shock and awe. Talk Unchained.
Talk Unchained with Marlon Aldridge every Monday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, live only on American Muslim 360 Blog Talk Radio, the number one Islamic radio station in America.
Good morning to our audience on American Muslim 360 on Blog Talk Radio, and welcome to Talk Unchained. I am your host, Marlon Aldridge. Today we discuss black economics and trade, self-defeating ideologies and strategies. There have been many predictions by economists over the last 30 years that black businesses would generate significantly more jobs for black people in comparison to the percentages they represent in the economy, which currently stands at 9.5% or close to 2.6 million businesses. By contrast, blacks represent 12.6% of the population. By comparison, non-Hispanic white-owned businesses comprise 70.9% of the total, while whites represent 62.8% of the population. As a whole, minority-owned businesses represent 29.3% of total businesses, while minorities represent 37.2% of the population. Moreover, black-owned businesses generate 1.3% of U.S. total sales and 1.7% total employment. I'm going to suggest today that despite lack of access to capital, lack of success in bidding and winning government contracts, and problems with recruiting, hiring, and retaining the best talent, we sabotage our economic growth by not valuing particular ideals and strategies. The best indicators of our values are our behaviors. For instance, people that value health and fitness eat right and stay active. Here are nine ideals and strategies that we collectively do not value based on our behaviors. And I'm going to confine my discussion here today to black business leaders. I'm not going to disparage in any kind of way black consumers. And, of course, before we get started, I want to encourage you to participate in our conversation. The call-in number is 515-605-9891. Again, that's 515-605-9891. If you have questions, press 1 to get in the queue. Please, no speakerphones or listening to the show on another medium, as this may present feedback cast. Black leaders, on average, do not value hiring employees even when they can. Do not value plans which allow them to enter into high-growth industries. Number 3, do not value value-added services which allow them to compete with large retail establishments like Walmart. Number 4, develop products and services which fit their needs, wants, and desires, and not the needs, wants, and desires of the larger market. Number 5, do not value or support black-run institutions like HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. Number 6, depend on the government to develop black-owned businesses and black neighborhoods. Number 7, do not value private equity and public offerings for capital. Do not value strategic alliances with other black-owned businesses And number nine, do not value knowledge of marketing and sales. And we're going to talk about each one of these independently. And I hope you understand what I'm theorizing here. And I'm using a little bit of psychology, and I'm working in reverse, and I'm using our behaviors as an indication of what we value. And that ought to make sense given the example that I've given you about health and fitness. And I am talking about on the average. And many of us, and I'm pretty sure some of you in the listening audience, are going to suggest that it is the consumer and not the business owner. But it is up to the business owner to meet the needs of the consumer, and that is not, and it is not the other way around. So I'm going to be operating from the position that we as black business owners need to do more. Not only do we need to do more individually, but we need to do more collectively in terms of plans. Well, let me back up. Goals, plans, and strategies. That's going to be very important for us to come together and develop goals, plans, and strategies. And I'll suggest that other minorities communities are doing that, in particular the Asian communities, because there's some data that's out by the Small Business Administration that is going to suggest that these businesses are doing, or some of the businesses, minority businesses, are actually gaining parity, while black businesses, in particular, their growth has not appreciably increased in terms of percentage of sales and percentage of employees with non-Hispanic white businesses. Those disparities still exist, and we can go back 30 years or so and find that to be the case. So let's go over some general statistics here that you may or may not be aware of concerning black business. Well, first of all, there are about 27.6 million total businesses in the United States. And I'm quoting from the survey of small business owners. And those businesses represented about $33 trillion in sales. Let's contrast that the number of black-owned firms, which has risen appreciably over since the last survey was taken. There are now approximately 2.5 total black-owned businesses, about 2.5, with sales of $144 billion. Let's go back and talk about number of firms with paid employees, because I think this is where the rubber meets the road. If we are not providing employment for others, then really what's the purpose other than self-aggrandizement? And I'm going to show you also that when we look at the sales per non-employer firms, we might as well say that it would be better. Well, let me hold that one. I want to surprise you on that one. I want to surprise you on that one. Number of total firms, that have paid employees, about 5.4 million firms in the U.S. employ. Now, black firms, the number that employ is 100. I'm going to round it up to about 105,000. 105,000. That is about 4% compared to all businesses, which is about 20%. Percentage of paid employees is about 20%. White-owned businesses, when you look at them, that percentage goes up a little to 21%. And Asian businesses with paid employees is about 25%. Now, I have some other numbers here, but we'll get into that, into those numbers. We'll dig into them just a little bit later in the show. But I did want to provide some evidence for the first assumption that I made, is that black business leaders on average do not value hiring employees even when they can. Now, with my nonprofit, part of that mission is to develop and support black-owned businesses. So in some of the programs that I run, I have attempted to get business owners together for the purpose of forming strategic alliances and also trying to help them from a consultant standpoint to put them in a position where that they could hire employees. And much of the feedback that I received from them suggested to me that they didn't want the, that was too much trouble hiring employees. There were always excuses for not wanting to hire employees, like they're not dependable. And there was an array of excuses. So it's more than just not having the capital to be able to do it. There apparently is a lack of value for many black leaders or black business leaders to hire employees. Again, and the numbers sort of buttress or reinforce what I have said. These numbers historically have been low in terms of our percentage of black businesses that employ anyone. So you're looking at about 96%. Now, the last time I checked, because I follow these numbers regularly, and it looks like to me that the percentage of black-owned firms that have paid employees is going down. And the last time I checked, 95% of black-owned businesses had no employees. And now it's 96%. And the numbers that I am quoting or the percentages are from the 2007 survey of small business owners. We're now up to the data that I'm quoting you today is from the 2012. Every 5 years, they will conduct a survey of small business owners. So we can see that percentage of employers is gone down, at least for black businesses. And that's very important. We need to gain parity with non-Hispanic white businesses if we want to see our per capita incomes go up, if we want to see median household incomes go up, to see our communities in better shape. It is imperative that black businesses do more in terms of working together and in terms of developing goals, plans, and strategies to overcome any obstacles. So see, I'm contending today that regardless of what the obstacles are, we are intelligent enough to overcome them. And see, that's the major part of the problem is understanding what the hurdles are. Once you understand what the hurdles are, then to, at least from my mode of thinking, there is no reason that if when working together that we shouldn't be able to develop, like I said, goals, plans, and strategies, which would allow us to overcome those hurdles. And as I have stated, these disparities in terms of sales and employment persist. Now, I said earlier, and I was about to make the comment, that there is a point at which people decide that, hey, is it beneficial for me to go into business versus going to get a job? Now, look at these numbers here. Let's look at all firms. Sales per employer. The sales per employer, if we look at all the $6 million per firm. Now, when we break that down in terms of race, sales of black-owned employer firms, they generate close to a million, really $954,000 per black-owned firm. When we get to white-owned employer firms, it's closer to $2.2 million per firm, firms $1.3 million, Hispanic firms $1.3 million, minority firms overall about $1.3 million. So you can see that we're underachieving even in terms of a minority firm, we are underachieving. Now let's look at the non-employer firms. If we look at all firms, the average non-employer firm generates about $47 million in sales. With the black firms, now watch this, $19 million. $19,000 per black-owned non-employer firm, $19,000. Now, I'm not sure, but depending on your household size, that's poverty. And so we have a lot of work to do in that regard. If we look at white-owned non-employer firms, we're closer back up to the average. They're looking at $49,000 per firm. For Asian, about $50,000 per firm. Minority firms as a whole, about $31,000 per minority non-employer firm. So very important for us to understand really what it looks like our business leaders are doing is that they are looking for self-employment and not looking to become employers. And this has historically case. So here's another thing that we have to consider is that if the number of black firms is increasing above the number of all firms as a whole, what that suggests to me is that we are competing with one another. So those sales per non-employer firm and the sales per firm as a total along the lines of race, if we look at black firms, yes, we are growing the number of firms, but the number of sales per firm, black-owned firm, is in no way gaining parity with all firms as a whole. Black, white, non-Hispanic white firms and Asian firms in particular. So it's very important for us to understand that. And the U.S. minority population has grown rapidly. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, 37% of the U.S. population identifies as part of at least one minority class. The populations of five states, including the two largest, California and Texas, are now over 50% minorities. Many other states, counties, and cities are approaching this threshold. Thus, understanding minority business ownership is increasingly important. Nationwide, 29% of businesses are majority owned by minorities, and this share is quickly increasing. The recently released 2012 survey of business owners provides a unique opportunity to examine how specific minority groups are performing in the economy as a whole. The disparities they face in sales, and we've already talked about that, I did want to give you some more information concerning the numbers, but I wanted to make sure that I made my way through all of what I consider to be value propositions. Value propositions. I said, we do not value plans which allow them to enter into high growth industries. And we need to talk about what these high growth industries are. So I have some numbers on that that I'm going to share with you. And it is very important that I understand that in many of these industries are going to be capital intensive. But nonetheless, knowing that, as I stated earlier, we need to develop goals, plans, and strategies which allow us to get into the top 20 industries by sales. Let's talk about what those industries are. Petroleum and petroleum products merchant wholesalers. Percentage of industry groups, percentage of industry owned by non-minorities, 88%, and minorities, 11%. Okay, so petroleum by industry is number one. Then petroleum and coal products manufacturing, again, those numbers, non-minority, 88%, and minority, 11%. Basic chemical manufacturing, 82% non-minority, 17% minority. Another high-growth industry is insurance carriers, 90% non-minority, 8% minority. Wired telecommunications carriers, 86% non-minority, 13% minority. Dairy product manufacturing, 69% non-minority, 30% minority. Most of the companies, well, let me take that back. Most of the companies in 20 industries by sales are in manufacturing. So it's important for us to understand that these are capital-intensive industries, but I believe with the right planning and the right value proposition for these particular types of companies that we can gain entry into these companies because, excuse me, into these industries. It is important because they are the highest paying industries. Your manufacturing companies provide living wage jobs and all of the benefits that go with that. Now, let's contrast that with the bottom 20 industries by sale. Personal services, other personal services, 61% non-minority, 39% minority. We can see how the percentages for minorities goes up appreciably in these areas. Here's one that you ought to understand. Child daycare services, 40% non-minority, 60% minority. Personal care services like barbers and beauticians, 41% non-minority, 58% minority. Independent artists, writers, and performers, 77% non-minority, 23% minorities. Let's give you some here that where minorities are involved at rates higher than their percentage of the population. Community food and housing, relief services, 54% non-minority, 46% minority. How about taxi and limousine services, 33% non-minority, 67% minority. What are some other big ones here? Home health care services, 39% non-minority, 61% minority. And special food services, 52% non-minority, 47% minority. Again, those are the bottom 20 industries by sales, and those are the industries that we appear to be relegated to. Now, we do have some manufacturers. As a matter of fact, if you follow the BET top 100 industrial firms, you'll find that there are some in the auto, mainly in the automotive and food manufacturing industries, where we do have some companies that are doing well, but it's not. Excuse me, it's not many. So it's important for us to develop goals, plans, and strategies that will allow us to get into sales where there's more money and thus more demand. Very important that we do that. Now, of course, this has always been the contention with retail establishments, and of course, many of our companies find themselves in the retail industry, somewhere around 9%. We should be trying to get more into the service industries because there's more opportunities there to compete as opposed to the retail establishments where there's a lot like Walmart and other national chains. Many of these companies are publicly traded as well, so it's going to be hard to compete with them because they're able to buy so much and get discounts on their product buys because of their ability to negotiate those discounts because of huge volumes. And it is not that black consumers will not shop with black stores, products, or service. Most American consumers are looking for the best buy, the most convenient, best quality within a relatively short distance from where they are. And that's really where I am. Of course, I want to support black businesses, but I'm not going to suffer on price. I'm not going to suffer on quality. And, well, I may travel a little bit further, but if I had my druthers, I wouldn't want to. So we're going to have to do more in terms of competing for people like me, and I'm sure that many of you feel the same way. We're going to have to do things that allow us to be more competitive, and I'm suggesting that value-added services will allow us to do that. In other words, we won't be able to get the price breaks for products, but that doesn't mean that we can't add value-added services. Let me give you an example. Let's say if you sell tires, and your tires, you can't compete on price. That doesn't mean that you can't offer your clients, like, say, you're able to balance those tires every so often. Check air pressure to rotate the tires. Something to that effect, which adds value to the purchase, so somebody or consumer would understand or would be able to overlook the higher price because you're adding additional value. Now, that's just an example. Each business would have to look at their own situation in terms of their ability to be able to provide value-added services. That's just one example. We need, and these are ways and strategies that we could utilize to overcome not being able to get those discounts on our product buys. I'm talking about at the wholesale level and on and by retail establishments. Develop products and services which fit their needs, wants, and desires and not the needs, wants, and desires of the larger market. And I've already talked about this a little bit. I can give you a little bit more detail. While the number of minority-owned businesses is growing rapidly, proportionate amounts are in the lowest 20 industries in terms of sales. In aggregate, almost 58.9% of all African-American-owned businesses are in the 20 lowest sales-generating industries, and some of those I mentioned earlier, as are about 44.5% of all Hispanic-owned businesses. In contrast, only 30.6% of all non-minority businesses are in these industries. Again, in aggregate, almost 58.9% of all African-American-owned businesses are in the 20 lowest sales-generating industries. That's almost 60%. In the high sales industries, on the other hand, there is a disproportionately small share of minority business ownership. On average, 13.1% of businesses in these industries are owned by minorities, with nine industries having less than 10% minority ownership. Further, a minority-owned business is 64% less likely to be part of the top 20 sales industries compared to non-minority businesses. So if we want to provide living wage jobs, if we want to be able to hire employees for those firms that anticipate and want to do that, we have to get into industries where the sales are greater and the competition is a little bit less. And again, I know that these are capital-intensive industries, but we understand that, so we need to operate in advance in a collaborative fashion come these hurdles. Very important that we do this. And if you follow me, you understand that I understand the importance of HBCU. So this next value proposition that we lack is we do not value or support black-run institutions like historically black colleges and universities. The National Center for Education Statistics figures show that in fall 2015, the combined total of enrollments for all HBCUs was 293,000, compared with 234,000 in 1890. By comparison, enrollment at universities and enrollment at all universities and college nearly doubled during this time. So HBCUs are having a problem competition for predominantly white institutions. You can see that overall, the enrollments have nearly doubled since 1980, whereas with HBCUs, that is not the case. 9% of black college students were enrolled at an HBCU in 2005. Really, that number is about 8.5%. Now, we contrast that with 1980, that number was 17.3%. So we can see that enrollments are going down at HBCUs. But let's look at the importance of HBCUs. And I, along with Tom Joyner, are avid supporters of HBCUs. And there was a new Gallup Purdue University report was based on surveys of black students at both HBCUs and non-HBCUs about their particular sentiments. And black students are more likely to feel supported and be engaged in work after graduation if they attend historically black colleges and universities. The survey went on to report that about 55% of all black HBCU graduates said they strongly agreed that their college or university prepared them well for life outside of college, compared to less than 30% of non-HBCU black graduates. More than half of HBCU graduates reported thriving in purpose well-being, compared to 43% of black graduates from non-HBCUs. While 29% of black graduates who did not attend an HBCU said they were thriving in financial well-being, 51% of black HBCU graduates reported doing so. I want to point out that this was a very extensive survey taken by this Gallup Purdue University poll. Black graduates of HBCUs were more than twice as likely as those who graduated from predominantly white institutions to recall feeling supported by a professor. And about half of HBCU graduates said their college or university was the perfect school. for them compared to 34% of non-HBCU black alumni. And nearly half said that they couldn't imagine a world without the HBCU they attended. Only 25% of black graduates of predominantly white institutions agreed. For Hispanic students attending Hispanic-serving institutions versus non-Hispanic-serving institutions, the differences were not as striking. And researchers can't say for sure why Hispanic students don't thrive emotionally at Hispanically-serving institutions in the way black students do at HBCUs, but one strong hypothesis lies in the different ways the institutions are categorized. While HBCUs are typically defined by having an institutional mission completely devoted to serving black students, Hispanic-serving institutions are defined as colleges or universities in which Hispanic students make up 25% of the total enrollment. So they're defined in different ways. And Brandon Busteed, executive director of Gallup Education and Workforce Development, said HBCUs are designated as such because there's a distinction around their intuitional mission and purpose, Busteed said. But with Hispanic-serving institutions, they're defined by enrollment numbers, not mission. One of the things I pointed out in a number of writings and articles is that the mission of an HBCU is important. And I suggest to people all the time that you want to attend an HBCU that has this component in their mission statement. It has to be around leadership development. And I find that those HBCUs that have a component of leadership development in their mission statements, those colleges and universities serve African-American students well, because many of our elected officials have graduated from HBCUs. And I've done a study here. I haven't completed it for Dayton and Montgomery County, but those differences are positive in terms of the two HBCUs here, Central State University and Wilberforce University. As a matter of fact, I'd go out to say that most of the elected judges, black judges, were graduates from Wilberforce University, while many of the commissioners, the city commissioners, were graduates of Central State University. I've yet to complete that study, but there was also a study done back in the 90s, and if I can recall the numbers, that HBCUs produced over 80% of all judges, over 50% of lawyers and doctors, and about 40% of Congress people. So that's very significant given their size, which is about 3%. They represent about 3% of all colleges and universities, but yet they graduate significant numbers of those in fields that where the salaries are greatest, like say in STEM fields. Although they only represent 3% of colleges and universities, they graduate about 20% of blacks in the STEM fields. So that's pretty significant, because we know that those students are going to make more money. So what I'm suggesting here is that we have to value HBCUs because of what they contribute to the economy in terms of leadership, black leadership in particular, and in terms of salaries. We're going to make more money at graduating from an HBCU than you're going to make graduating from a predominantly white serving institution. Very important to understand that. Even given all of the hurdles that these HBCUs have, I know that retention is a problem for many of them. And that's, if we really look at some of these numbers, That has to do with not being able to recruit many times the best performing students. And then, of course, low enrollments are a problem, too. If you have low enrollments, you're not going to have the money to be able to hire the best faculty and to put forth some of the best programs. So we have to value these institutions. It is not enough for us. Let me back up. And those institutions are going to have, like, again, I don't want to blame the consumer. We really need to put the onus on the administrators and the trustees of these HBCUs. They're going to, number one, like I said, they're going to have to relook at those mission statements. And because the mission statements comport to what they are producing. Again, I made the observation, and I've done the research, that suggests that HBCUs that have a component of leadership in their mission statements, those students go on to do just that, become leaders. So that's very important. They're going to have to look at the types of programs that they offer and develop programs that are in those high-growth industries that we mentioned earlier. Very important for that to happen as well. So what are some of the other things that we have discussed as the value proposition? HBCUs, we talked about the benefits of attending HBCUs, and I'll tell you again, I am an avid proponent of HBCUs. And you know, just to give you some aside, I am also suggesting here to local leaders that the city of Dayton look to merge with some of the outlying suburbs to increase its census so that Dayton, which is the sixth largest city in Ohio, could possibly become the fifth largest city in Ohio. There's benefits to that from a political standpoint and from an economic standpoint as well. And in addition to that, I would like to see Central State University and Wilberforce University, which are in Wilberforce, which is not part of Dayton and not part of Montgomery County, where Dayton is located. I would like to see those institutions move within city limits of Dayton. I think that would serve African Americans in particular. It would serve them greatly to be able to be near these particular institutions. And then, of course, the economic impact would be great as well. As I have said earlier, many of these institutions face low student body enrollments. I'll give you an example. Central State University has a goal to have a student body of about 6,100 students. That's their goal, and they only have about 1,700 students. So, yes, many of us would suggest that, hey, these colleges are not doing well, but you can see that part of that is a financial problem. So their board of trustees need to develop goals, not only goals, but they need to be realistic and be chance takers in terms of positioning themselves to achieve their student body goal of 6,100. I don't even want to talk about Wilberforce. They're on the verge of, that's the oldest private HBCU, but it's on the verge of bankruptcy. So they're having huge problems. But if you recall, U.S. Congressman Floyd Flake used to be the president there and was a graduate from Wilberforce University. And as I have stated earlier, most of the judges, elected judges in this area, are graduates of Wilberforce University. So it's very important that we understand their importance to our communities. Depend on the government to develop black-owned businesses and neighborhoods. This is what I've heard. I don't really have any evidence. I couldn't find any surveys to back that up, but I'm going to say that generally that is the case, and I'd be open to anyone that has any knowledge about that. But I put that there anyway without the lack of evidence because here's what I'm seeing here locally, and I'm not going to suggest that what I see here locally is happening. No, I am going to say that. I'm going to suggest that what is happening here locally is probably a clear picture of what is happening nationally in terms of black-owned business development and neighborhood development. Is we are looking for the government to develop black businesses and to develop black neighborhoods when that is not their function. That is not their function to do that. Their function has always been a public function related to commonalities. It's had to do with civil protection, or the police departments, or fire departments, and things of that sort, developing and maintaining our roads. So from a transportation standpoint. And then, of course, administering to the powers given to them by state government. And those powers have nothing to do with building homes, for example. That's not their function to do that. It's not their function to develop private businesses. That's not a function of a public institution, is to develop private enterprise. That doesn't even make sense. As a matter of fact, that goes against all federal law that and state law that I am aware of. But yet, we are looking for the government to facilitate, well, to be the head. We're looking for the government to be the head. That is not their constitutional mission. Now, I'll tell you what they do, and around here, many of the black leaders have been upset with what's happening on the east side, which is majority white, but they really aren't understanding the whole picture. And the picture is this, is that the city government in particular will facilitate business development, but a private enterprise must take the lead. So in one of the districts here, business districts on the east side, there was a company that came from out of state, and they're wanting to put a lot of money in that particular area. So what the city did was to give them some land, basically for free. But the return on investment would be great. They were going to put, I think, somewhere on the order of about $20 million into this particular neighborhood, and the city gave up some land that amounted to no more than about $50,000. I don't know the numbers. I know they're low. I'm just trying to give you an example of how the government functions in terms of facilitating business. They will help those that want to help themselves. Now, I'm talking about private enterprises. Now, to the extent that we do not have private enterprises that have the resources, and we've already shown that many of them don't. If you don't come in with plans and resources, financial resources in particular, then the city is not going to be inclined to help you. And in general, government will not be inclined to help you if you are not willing to help yourself, especially being a private enterprise. It's very important. Understand that the government does not have a function or a mission to be the leaders in what are otherwise private pursuits. Legally or constitutionally, they can't do that. So we have to get away from that attitude of wanting the government to take the lead on particular issues, and we have to develop goals, plans, and strategies among private enterprises that allow us to go into particular neighborhoods or particular areas of town where the government has resources there and can help accommodate us in trying to set up communities and business districts. Very important for us to get that value proposition right. We live in a country which is based on and functions for predominantly private enterprise. We do not value private equity and public offerings. Let me give you some numbers on that to support my statement. All firms or firms which sought venture capital, now this is for all firms, was about 39,000, a little over 39,000 firms, or about 0.14%. So it wasn't many, but I wanted to include this because we know those publicly traded companies employ a whole lot of people. Very important for us to understand that publicly traded companies employ a whole lot of people. But when we break this down according to race and ethnicity, we see that only about 1,200 black-owned firms sought venture capital. This was about 0.05%. 0.05%. Compared to whites, 33,000, over 33,000 firms sought venture capital. This was about 0.16%. So, again, these numbers are large, but you can still see the disparities. 0.16% to 0.05%. That's about a margin a little bit over three, a factor of three. Firms, 2,800 or close to the – well, actually a little over the average. The average was 0.14%. Asian firms sought venture capital, 0.15% of those firms sought – of those that responded sought venture capital. So very important for us to understand that. Now, if we look at all minority firms, about 6,600 of respondents sought venture capital. That was about 0.08%, so that we can see that black firms are even underachieving and valuing seeking venture capital. Now, this probably has to do a lot with the industries that they're in. Venture capitalists are not going to fund businesses that are in low sales industries. And we've already said that close to 60% of black-owned businesses are in low sales industries. So some of these things work hand-in-hand in terms of being detriments. Being in a low-growth industry, of course, is going to put you in a negative position when you go to seek venture capital. Very important to understand that. I want to back up here because our percentage black employees. Now, I want to disabuse you of the notion that black-owned firms hire black employees. That's not the case. Now, I was able to generate some numbers from research that those numbers would be anywhere from 44% to about 64% of black-owned firms. Those are the percentages of black employees. So black-owned firms don't hire only black employees. 40 to 60% of their employees are black. So we can imagine that as these companies do gain parity in terms of the percentage of employees that they are able to hire compared to the whole, that many of them will have benefits for non-blacks as well. And that's fair. That's fair. What did I say the last one was, I tell you what, we're at that point where, and this time goes so fair here, so fast. I don't see, open up the lines here for the last part. If for callers, if you have any questions or comments, go ahead and press 1 to get in the queue. What are some other propositions that we don't value? Do not value strategic alliances with other black-owned businesses. And that is very important that we do that. I've talked with business owners, like, say, in my consulting work, and one of the things I've tried to suggest is strategic alliances with complementary firms. I mean, you don't want to have a strategic alliance with somebody who's in the who offers the same product or service as you do, but it would be advantageous to have a strategic alliance of some sort with a business that complements yours. Let's say, for example, that if you were in the janitorial business and you provide janitorial services and janitorial services only, you may want to align yourself with a business that does maintenance. And these are just examples so that you're able to add more value for your clients. And also, it also allows both of you to tap into your various industries. They'd be able to tap into your industry while you would be able to tap into their industry or client base. So strategic alliances are very important, and we need, and let me back up now. We have to be very strategic, like I said, in terms of who we align ourselves, what type of businesses and business owners we align ourselves with, because and as I've intimated here in the title of the show, we're looking at values. We're looking at values. You're the two companies that would strategically align, and it's not strategic if your values are not the same. So I'm suggesting that values are extremely important, and they're often not talked about. Values. And many of the reasons that we get into trouble with each other is that when we do try to strategically align ourselves with other businesses, we mismatch values, and thus it ends up being a bad relationship. And we don't want to have bad relationships. So we need to do our homework up front to ensure that we are aligning ourselves with businesses that have the same values that we have. So that's very important as well. And we're nearing the end of our show, and I have one more. Do not value knowledge of marketing and sales. That's a big one. We don't value knowledge of marketing and sales. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the complaints that black business owners, I'm looking at a survey here, they listed marketing and sales as the fourth obstacle. Funding, cash flow, and finances was number one. Survey business owners, about 42.1% of them reported that funding, cash flow, and finances was a problem. Bidding and winning contracts, about 26% of them said that there was a problem. 17% said that retaining and recruiting employees was a problem, and 16.5% reported marketing and sales was a problem. And, you know, that's important because, and I'll give you some an example, and I think that many of you can agree with this, is that, yes, we want to support black businesses, but we don't want to have to look for them. Who wants to look for a business when you have businesses constantly advertising? You go to the mailbox, what do you see? You see advertisements for various products and services. You turn on the TV, you see advertisements for various products and services from local merchants and national merchants. They're constantly in your face. Now, how much of this do we see from black businesses? Now, again, I understand that many times it's a cash flow problem. But we have these large frontal lobes, and we are just as intelligent as anyone else. What we need to do is first value marketing and sales, set goals and plans in order to make sure that our products and services are out there so that when black consumers and any other consumer, by that matter, which is looking for this products and services, are able to find them. So, again, the onus is on black business leaders, not the consumer. So we need to get out of this mindset of blaming the consumer when it is really the black business owner that should be trying to position themselves so that black consumers and other consumers do not have to go looking for these businesses. Very important to understand that. Well, we're at the end of our show, and I hope this was informative for our listening audience. We're going to continue to talk about economics and business, as it is very important to our communities, and we'd like to encourage you to listen to other episodes of Talk Unchained by going to blogtalkradio.com/AmericanMuslim360 and searching for Talk Unchained among the on-demand episodes, or searching in the search box near the top of the website. Also want to encourage you to listen to other shows on American Muslim 360 later on tonight, starting at 7 p.m., Until next week, we'll have you back. Time, same place, same intellectual stimulation. Follow me on Facebook. Assalamu alaikum.